his wife's foibles good-naturedly, but he could only be pushed so far. The audience had to believe that I lived in fear and trembling of my husband's wrath, and with Desi, they could. There was also a chemistry, a strong mutual attraction between us, which always came through. At the very first story conference, Desi laid down the underlying principles of the show. The humor could never be mean or unkind. Neither Ricky nor Lucy would ever flirt seriously with anyone else. Mothers-in-law would not be held up to ridicule. Most of all, Desi insisted on Ricky's manhood. He refused to ever be a nincompoop husband. When Lucy's got something up her sleeve that will make Ricky look like a fool, let the audience know that I'm in on the secret, he told our writers. I had always known that Desi was a great showman. But many were surprised to learn he was a genius, with keen instincts for comedy and plot. He has a quick, brilliant mind. He can instantly find the flaw in any storyline. And he has inherent good taste and an intuitive knowledge of what will and will not play. He's a great producer, a great director. He never stays on too long or allows anybody else to. When we had the characters of Lucy and Ricky clear in our minds, Jess Oppenheimer suggested that we add another man and wife, an older couple, in a lower income bracket. The writers could then pit couple against couple and the men against the women. I had known Bill Frawley since my RKO starlet days as a great natural comic. We all agreed upon him for Fred Mertz. We then started thinking about a TV wife for Bill. We considered a number of actresses, and then one day, Desi heard about a fine actress from the Broadway stage named Vivian Vance. She was appearing that summer in The Voice of the Turtle at La Jolla Playhouse. The ride down the coast was too much for my advanced state of pregnancy, so Jess and Desi drove down without me. They liked the way Vivian handled herself on the stage and the way she could flip a comedy line, so they hired her on the spot. As far as I was concerned, it was kismet. Viv and I were extraordinarily compatible. We both believe wholeheartedly in what we call an enchanted sense of play and use it liberally in our show. It's a happy frame of mind, the light touch, skipping into things instead of plodding. It's looking at things from a child's point of view and believing. The only way I can play a funny scene is to believe it. Then I can convincingly eat like a dog under a table, freeze to death beneath burning hot Klieg lights, or bake a loaf of bread 10 feet long. We had no way of knowing how comical she and Bill would be together. Vivian was actually much younger than Bill. Up till then, she'd usually been cast in glamorous other woman parts. But she went along gamely with Ethel Mertz's dowdy clothes, no false eyelashes or eye makeup, and hair that looked as if she had washed and set it herself. But she drew the line at padding her body to look fatter. Time and again she told Jess Oppenheimer, "If my husband in this series makes fun of my weight and I'm actually fat, then the audience won't laugh. They'll feel sorry for me. But if he calls me a fat old bag and I'm not too heavy, then it'll seem funny." Vivian was unhappy in her marriage to actor Phil Ober, and so she ate. After a while, Jess stopped insisting that she pad herself. On summer vacations, she'd diet. And once, she came back on the set positively svelte. "Well, Vivian," I kidded her, "you've got just 2 weeks to get fat and sloppy again." She and Bill scrapped a good deal, and this put a certain amount of real feeling into their stage quarrels. Bill became the hero of all henpecked husbands. He couldn't walk down the street without some man coming up to him and saying, "Boy, Fred, you tell that Ethel off something beautiful." So much good luck was involved in the casting. Early in the series, our writers wanted to write a show in which the Mertzes had to sing and dance. We then learned for the first time that both Vivian and Bill had had big musical comedy careers. Vivian had been in Skylark with Gertrude Lawrence, and Bill was a well-known vaudeville hoofer. I had insisted upon having a studio audience. Otherwise, I knew we'd never hit the right tempo. We did the show every Thursday night in front of 400 people, a cross-section of America. I could visualize our living and working together on the set like a stock company, then filming it like a movie, and at the same time staging it like a Broadway play. "We'll have opening night every week," I chortled. Desi's first problem was that there were no movie studios in Hollywood with accommodations for an audience. We also wanted a stage large enough to film the show in its natural sequence with no long delays setting up stage decorations or shifting lights. Desi hired Academy Award-winning cameraman Carl Freund, whose work I had admired at MGM, and discussed the problems with him. Carl flew to New York for a week to see how television cameras could be moved around without interfering too much with the audience's view of the action. He came back pretty unimpressed. There are no rules for our kind of show. So, we to make up our own. Carl Freund hit upon a revolutionary new way of filming a show with three cameras shooting the action simultaneously. One of these cameras is far back, another recording the medium shots, with a third getting the close-ups. The film editor then has three different shots of a particular bit of action. By shifting back and forth between the three, he can get more variety and flexibility than with the one-camera technique. But moving three huge cameras about the stage between the actors and the audience called for the most complex planning. First, Desi rented an unused movie studio. By tearing down partitions, he joined two giant sound stages. This gave us enough room to build three permanent sets, the Ricardo living room, bedroom, and kitchen, and a fourth set, which was sometimes the New York nightclub where Ricky worked, and sometimes an alligator farm or a vineyard in Italy or the French Alps, whatever the script called for. We even turned that 30-foot set into the deck of the USS Constitution once. The roving cameras couldn't roll easily on the wooden stage, so a smooth, concrete floor was laid down. Each week, a complicated pattern of chalk instructions was drawn on the cement, indicating each camera's position for every shot. This is known as camera blocking, and took 2 full days. Desi and I okayed each pillow, picture, pot, and pan that went into the Ricardo's apartment to make sure it was authentically middle income. While the three rooms slowly took form before our eyes, bleachers for 300 people were built facing them. The Los Angeles Fire and Health Departments threw a mountain of red tape at us when they learned we were inviting a large weekly audience into a movie studio. Desi had to add restrooms, water fountains, and an expensive sprinkler system. Microphones were installed over the heads of the audience. We wanted our laughs live. Some of the canned laughter you hear today came from our Lucy Show audiences. Desi and I were so excited and happy, planning our first big venture together. I thought that I Love Lucy was a pleasant little situation comedy that might even survive its first season, but my main thought centered on the baby. The nursery wing was now complete, and I planned to have a natural delivery late in June. And so I happily waited and waited, 30 pounds heavier than ever before. I was so proud of that big stomach of mine. Desi, knowing that my grandmother, Florabel, had been one of 5 sets of twins, expected triplets. The weeks passed, and still, no baby. Finally, my obstetrician decided on a cesarean delivery. Lucy Desiree Arnaz was lying sideways with her head just under my ribcage. When they performed the cesarean, the surgical knife missed her face by a hair's breadth. But miss her it did. She was complete, healthy, and beautiful. She arrived at 8:15 a.m. on July 17, 1951, weighing 7 pounds, 8 ounces. Lyricist Eddie Maxwell wrote the words to a song in her honor. There's a brand new baby at our house. And Desi sat up all night with his guitar composing the music. The next day, the proud papa passed out Havana cigars to his entire studio audience and introduced his new daughter and that song to the world on his new CBS radio show, Tropical Trip. Later on, it was used on the show when Lucy Ricardo had her baby. The day that Lucy and I were to leave the hospital, Desi appeared in a long, dark blue sedan, our new family car. He drove us home at a sedate crawl, and the baby and her nurse were installed in their private wing. Lucy's coming changed our life completely. Before, there had been 2 professional people in the house, discussing deals and contracts and money matters and scripts. Now suddenly there was a fragile little new spark of life there, affecting everything we thought or did. God, how I love babies. Not just my own, but the world's babies. I'm so sorry that I can't have any more. I had to go right back to work after Lucy was born, so I missed hours and hours and hours of her earliest life. When Lucy stopped sleeping most of the day, it got especially tough to leave her for the studio. Once there, I was seldom home again before midnight. During the early days of the I Love Lucy show, I only had Sundays free. So I spent this time entirely with my new baby, marveling at her. It took me a long time to recover physically from Lucy's birth, but I had no time to pamper myself. 6 weeks after she arrived, I walked on the Lucy set to start filming the series. Rehearsals got underway to the pounding of hammers and buzzing of saws. The set was only half built, and the whole wall of the soundstage was still missing when we started. Jesse was so nervous that he memorized everybody's lines and moved his own lips as they spoke. He also kept flicking his eyes around the stage, watching the progress of the three cameras. He soon got over this, but proved to be the fastest learner of dialogue. To my delight, I discovered that the I Love Lucy show drew from everything I'd learned in the movies, radio, the theater, and vaudeville. I wanted everything about the venture to be top flight. The timing, the handling of props, the dialogue. We argued a good deal at first because we all cared so passionately. Sometimes we'd discuss phrasing or word emphasis in a line of dialogue until past midnight. Bill Frawley couldn't understand the need for all this hair-splitting. He'd tear his part out of the script, memorize it, and pay no attention to what the rest of us were saying or doing. Vivian, like me, was a perfectionist who took her profession very seriously. "Now, what's my motivation here?" she'd ask me or Desi or Jess, and this would launch a half-hour discussion. Bill couldn't have cared less. If he got his big laugh, he didn't care how or why. And actually, Bill can be funny doing nothing. He has that kind of face, and in any kind of costume, he's hilarious. During one early rehearsal, Vivian was championing a particular way in which a line should be spoken. Nobody agreed with her, but she kept explaining and explaining until finally we did see the logic of her position. By this time, it was 2 a.m., and she was so wound up she couldn't stop talking. She went on and on until Desi tapped her gently on the shoulder. "Vivian, your yo-yo string is tangled." I could sense a flaw in the storyline or dialogue, but I couldn't always put my objections into words. Frustrated, Desi would burst into a flood of Spanish. I'd express my frustrations by getting mad. Vivian was a tower of strength in such circumstances. She would intuitively guess what was wrong and then analyze it. She would make a great director. We rehearsed the first show 12 hours a day. Then, on Friday evening, August 15th, 1951, the bleachers filled up by 8 o'clock, and Desi explained to the audience that they would be seeing a brand new kind of television show. He stepped behind the curtain, and we all took our places. Sitting in the bleachers that first night were a lot of anxious rooters, Dee Dee and Desi's mother Dolores, our writers, Andrew Hickox, and a raft of Philip Morris representatives and CBS officials. To launch the series, the network had paid out $300,000. They hoped it would last long enough to pay back that advance. We were lucky all the way. The first four shows put us among the top 10 on television. Arthur Godfrey, one of the giants, preceded us and urged his watchers to stay tuned to I Love Lucy. Our 20th show made us number one on the air, and there we stayed for three wild, incredible years. I Love Lucy has been called the most popular television show of all time. Such national devotion to one show can never happen again. There are too many shows on many more channels now. But in 1951 to 1952, our show changed the Monday night habits of America. Between 9 and 9:30, taxis disappeared from the streets of New York. Marshall Field's department store in Chicago hung up a sign, "We love Lucy too, so from now on we'll be open Thursday nights instead of Monday." Telephone calls across the nation dropped sharply during that half hour, as well as the water flush rate as whole families sat glued to their seats. That season, Red Skelton got the Emmy Award in February 1952, but told the nation, "You gave this to the wrong redhead." "I don't deserve this. It should go to Lucille Ball." During our first season, someone told Desi that our show had hit a rating of 70. He looked worried, thinking that a grade of 70 was barely passing. "You're kidding," he said, not realizing that a rating of 70 was indeed phenomenal. In May 1952, Desi and I both walked into Jess Oppenheimer's office, elated.
"Well, amigo," Desi told Jess, "we just heard from the doctor. Lucy's having another baby in January. So we'll have to cancel everything. That's the end of the show." My feelings were mixed. I felt bad for the cast, the crew, and the writers. I regretted that our dream of working together was again busted. But my predominant feeling was still one of elation. Another baby. And I was almost 41. Jess sat looking at us silently. Then he remarked casually, "I wouldn't suggest this to any other actress in the world, but why don't we continue the show and have a baby on TV?" Desi's face lit up. "Do you think we could? Would it be in good taste?" No actress had ever appeared in a stage or television play before when she was obviously pregnant. "We'll call the CBS censor and see," said Jess. That wonderful guy said, "Well, I don't see why not." And with his active encouragement, Philip Morris and the network went along with it. We had just finished 40 Lucy shows, 10 months of backbreaking work with hardly a let-up, but now we made feverish plans to get into production for the next season as fast as possible. The baby would be delivered by cesarean section, so we had a definite date to plan around, January 19th. We took only a 2-week vacation that summer, beginning the new shows in June. All through the hot, steamy Hollywood summer, we worked 10 and 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. In the early fall, when I was beginning to look pretty big, we did 7 shows concerning my pregnancy. These films were screened by a priest, a minister, and a rabbi for any possible violation of good taste. It was the CBS network that objected to using the word pregnant. They made us say expecting. The 3-man religious committee protested. "What's wrong with pregnant?" They were heartily in favor of what we were doing, showing motherhood as a happy, wholesome, normal family event. Many times on the Lucy show, the script was very close to reality. In real life, Desi and I had separated and reconciled many times, and the public knew this. So our writers did a script about Lucy and Ricky quarreling and separating. Ricky Ricardo moved out of the apartment, and I was supposed to walk around the living room set forlorn, touching each piece of furniture wistfully. To our writer's amazement, people in the studio audience took out their handkerchiefs and started weeping. Then when Ricky and Lucy were reconciled a few minutes later, in what was supposed to be a hilarious scene, nobody laughed. They were too happy and relieved to see us together again. Because the audience knew that Desi and I were really married, they assumed that Vivian Vance and Bill Frawley were, too. When Desi would announce, "And here's Vivian's real husband, Philip Ober," they would sit in stunned disbelief. Even Vivian's father was caught up in the make-believe. "Why don't you use your own name on the show?" he asked Vivian. "Fred Mertz does." Both times I was pregnant, I mooned for hours over a baby photograph of Desi, hoping by some magic I would have a baby who looked just like him. Then we did a show where Lucy tells Ricky she's having a baby. She sends an anonymous note to him at his nightclub, requesting that he sing "Rockabye Baby." Ricky complies, going from table to table singing the old nursery rhyme. In front of Lucy's table, he looks into her eyes and suddenly realizes that he is the father. When we did this scene before an audience, Desi was suddenly struck by all the emotion he'd felt when we discovered after 10 childless years of marriage that we were finally going to have Lucy. His eyes filled up and he couldn't finish the song. I started to cry too. Vivian started to sniffle. Even the hardened stagehands wiped their eyes with the back of their hands. The director wanted retakes at the end of the show, but the audience stood up and shouted, "No, no!" 12. The birth of little Desi has been described in a college history textbook as one of the great emotional events of 1953. I had quit doing the shows in November when I was carrying 33 extra pounds. During the following 7 weeks, we aired the sequence involving my pregnancy, filmed in September and October, but shown on TV screens in December and January. The baby's birth had been scheduled for Monday morning, January 19th, at Cedars of Lebanon Hospital. We had tried to keep the date a secret, but the news had leaked out that my real baby and Lucy Ricardo's fake baby would arrive on the same day. Flowers and telegrams in great profusion preceded my trip to the hospital. When Desi took me in that Sunday night, the bouquets already filled my room and half the corridor. One wire from a good friend read, "Well, don't just lie there, do something." They doped me up with pills, but I lay awake all night anyway. I had the same feelings of terror and desperate hope that any mother has. Oh, God, I prayed, just make it a normal, healthy baby. During the early morning operation, I was conscious the whole time. At 8:20 a.m., my baby was born. Desiderio Alberto Arnaz IV. At last, Desi had a son and heir to carry on his proud family traditions. That afternoon, I awoke to find Desi sitting on my bed sobbing. There were 7,000 letters and 1,000 telegrams waiting for me. But this was only the beginning. Counting the telegrams, letters, cards, phone calls, baby booties, and other gifts, 1 million people sent some expression of their good wishes for the new baby. Desi went to the Brown Derby that day, threw his hands up to the ceiling, and shouted, "Now we got everything!" The national hysteria continued for weeks. The same day our little Desi was born, 44 million Americans watched the arrival of Ricky Ricardo Jr. on the I Love Lucy show. The next day, Eisenhower was inaugurated as president, and the following Sunday night, Walter Winchell said on the air, "This was a banner week. The nation got a man and Lucy got a boy." This was a banner year in all respects for Desi and me. In February, we won 2 Emmy Awards, Best Comic Actress and Best Comedy Show. And Desi clinched an $8 million deal with Philip Morris, making us television's highest paid stars. In March, 2 months after little Desi's birth, I went back to work. In June, we were named Husband and Wife of the Year. We took 3 days off from the show and then went directly into production of MGM's A Long, Long Trailer. We did this movie from my old friend, producer Pandro Berman. My former studio, MGM, paid us $250,000, and fortunately, the show was a big moneymaker. I had Lana Turner's old dressing room, and Desi was in Clark Gable's. We took 1 month's vacation, then went right back to Stage 9 again for the Lucy show. During all this period, I was not getting my rest. I felt terribly tired. The smash success of our TV show and the physical strain of combining my last pregnancy with a full work schedule took its toll. I developed a feeling I couldn't shake. All our good fortune was suddenly going to vanish. When I tore myself away from my babies in the morning, I had this terrible fear that they'd be gone when I returned at night. Having the love and adoration of millions was wonderful and thrilling, but I could have done with half of our Lucy success, for with it came a lot of new stress. Desi had managed to cut our shooting schedule down to 5 days a week, but evenings and Saturdays and Sundays our house was filled with people running in and out consulting Desi on deals. By this time, he was producing other shows and giving technical assistance to still others. We had signed a 10-year lease on the Motion Picture Center in Hollywood, which we eventually bought for $750,000, and Desi was deeply involved in the reconstruction of 4 sound stages and hundreds of offices. He estimated, correctly, that by the end of 1953, Desi Liu would have completed 90 hours of film production and would be doing a gross business of millions of dollars. In addition to the production company, we also had a merchandising business. It was possible to furnish a house and dress a whole family with items carrying our I Love Lucy label. Red Skelton did a hilarious TV skit poking fun at this. As he walked into his house, his wife shouted, "Don't track mud on my I Love Lucy rug." As he started to sink into a chair, she added, "Don't mess up my I Love Lucy chair." He finally shoots her, and she moans, "You shot a bullet through my I Love Lucy blouse." One baby food company offered us $50,000 to use little Desi's name on their product, but we wouldn't even consider that, even though it was the same baby food he ate. In the middle of August 1953, we settled into a rented house on the beach in Del Mar, California, with both babies, a nurse, Desi's mother, and an assortment of house guests. It was then that I received a call that seemed to realize my anxious apprehension. The call was from William A. Wheeler, an investigator for the House Un-American Activities Committee. The committee wanted to hold a closed hearing with me, Dee Dee, and Freddie on September 4th in Hollywood. Freddie, now a salesman in Phoenix, Arizona, joined us at Del Mar
and we drove up together. Investigator Wheeler went over some statements we had made the previous year to the FBI about my communist connections. What had happened was that when Dorie Sherry and Larry Parks were subpoenaed to go to Washington in the late 1940s to appear before the House Un-American Activities Committee, Bill Holden and I went on the air to support them. We did that at the request of the Screenwriters Guild. When my own union told me my support was needed, I didn't ask questions. Then, after I spoke my piece for Sherry and Parks, some scandal sheet reporter went through all the voting records to see how I had registered over the years, and he found that in 1936 I registered as a communist. That was the year my grandfather Fred held all his political meetings in our garage at 1344 North Ogden Drive. He had a friend running for city council on the communist ticket, and he insisted that Dee Dee, Freddie, and I register so we could vote for him. We did it to please Daddy. He'd had one stroke already, and the least little argument got him all upset. So, in the spring of 1952, I talked to some FBI men for several hours at a meeting arranged at the ranch. The records show that I had registered as a communist voter in 1936. I never voted, however, and after 2 years, my registration lapsed. The FBI said that I had once been named to the California State Central Committee of the Communist Party. I said this was news to me, and that if my name was there, it was listed without my knowledge or consent. They also said that a member of the Communist Party had testified that she attended meetings at 1344 North Ogden Drive during 1936 and had never seen me at any of these meetings. I told the investigators that during 1936 I had been working at the RKO studios and in Lila Rogers' little theater group, 6 and 7 days a week. I was seldom home before midnight, and then I was only interested in getting some sleep, not attending a political meeting. The FBI men seemed satisfied. As far as they were concerned, I was cleared. They called me politically immature and saw no reason for further investigation of what was essentially an impulsive, emotional step I'd taken in my youth for the sake of my grandfather. So I had put the whole business out of my mind until I got Wheeler's call in Del Mar in August of the following year. At the hearing held September 4th, 1953, in Hollywood, I told him about my registering as a communist in 1936. I was of a mind to try and do something that would please Daddy. It just didn't seem like such an awful thing to do, the way it does these days. It was almost as terrible to be a Republican then. Then I was asked about a petition I had read over the radio about the plight of the Okies. I explained that a studio official had asked me to read it and that I had been excused from a picture to do so. According to my testimony, which was officially recorded that day, I swore, I have never done anything for the communists, to my knowledge, at any time. I have never contributed money or attended a meeting or had anything to do with people connected with it, if, to my knowledge, they were. I am not a communist now. I have never been. I never wanted to be. Nothing in the world could ever change my mind. At no time in my life have I ever been in sympathy with anything that even faintly resembled it. Again, we were completely cleared and assured that none of the secret testimony would go beyond the walls of that hearing room. But 2 days later, on Sunday night, September 6th, 1953, I was home alone at the ranch in Chatsworth with our two children listening to Walter Winchell's radio program, when he came out with a blind item. What top red-headed television comedian has been confronted with her membership in the Communist Party? I remember thinking, oh my gosh, do they think Imogene Coca is a communist? When Desi called from our beach house in Del Mar, where he'd spent the weekend with some poker buddies, he said, Lucy, were you listening to Winchell tonight? Of course. You know I always do. Do you believe that about Imogene? Lucy, he said as if scolding a small child, he's not talking about Coca. He means you. Me? I said as my knitting went flying. How can he? I'm on my way home. We'll be expecting some people about 1 a.m., he told me. Why? What are you having, a party? No, honey, he said seriously. You're in trouble. For years, I had known about Hollywood's insidious blacklist. The mere accusation of red activity against someone, a writer, actor, or director, could put that person under a permanent cloud, whether he was guilty or not. An actor could be cleared for one show and not for another, all on the same network. A writer could be denied credit for his work or find himself permanently unemployed by any studio. Television sponsors, fearing a boycott of their goods, quaked in their boots if anyone on their shows was even remotely tinged with the label of controversial. The most vicious thing about this blacklist was that anyone, even the most ignorant crank, could point the finger at someone and the charge could hold. I had now gone through 2 closed-door hearings on the matter before the FBI and the Un-American Activities Committee and had been cleared by both. But Walter Winchell's broadcast could still ruin me. I don't blame Walter Winchell. He had heard that the charge against me was going to be publicized in a magazine. He wanted the scoop. That's what he's paid for. But he might at least have been accurate. That Sunday night, Desi quickly rounded up Desilu officials, including our public relations man, Kenneth Morgan, who was then married to my cousin Cleo, along with press relations men from MGM, CBS, and Philip Morris. Our movie for MGM, The Long, Long Trailer, was not yet released, so the studio was also interested in protecting its investment in me. I told them all about my voting registration back in 1936. When they learned that I had been cleared by both the FBI and the Congressional Committee, they decided that nothing further need be done. Perhaps it would all blow over. 2 days passed. Then, on Wednesday, September 9th, Winchell's nationally syndicated column repeated the same statement he had made on the air. On Thursday, Jack O'Brien of the New York Journal-American wrote, "Lucille Ball plans to retire in 4 years. She will retire a lot sooner than she thinks." On Friday, the hot news broke. This was the day we'd planned to film the first show of the fall season. I rose early, as usual. Through the window, I saw 2 strange men in hats standing near our orchard. I woke Desi up. Still in his pajamas, he opened the door and asked what the men wanted. They said they were police reporters from the Los Angeles Herald Express sent to talk to me about my communist activities. Desi said firmly that I had no statement to make. We dressed as fast as we could and slipped out the back door. At the Desilu Studios, 25 miles away, everything was pandemonium. Reporters were everywhere. A cacophony of phones rang. By noon, the Herald Express had a 3-inch headline, "Lucille Ball named Red." 2 hours later, New Yorkers read in their 5 o'clock evening papers, "America's most beloved comedian is communist." It seemed to Desi and me that the first statement to the press should come from the Un-American Activities Committee, so I kept mum and away from reporters. In the morning, I sat under the hairdryer in pin curls, as usual, and did my nails. My hands shook. In the afternoon, I went through hours of comedy rehearsal, white-faced and with a devastating headache. Alfred Lyons, board chairman of Philip Morris, phoned me and said, "Lucy, I want to ask you 1 yes or no question. Are you a communist?" "No," I said. "That's good enough for me," he said. "If you want, you can cancel the show we planned for tonight. Take the full half hour of our TV time and explain to the public in any way you like what this nonsense is all about." I burst into tears and thanked him. I would have spoken to America, except at 6 o'clock that evening, Representative Donald L. Jackson, chairman of the House Un-American Activities Committee, called a press conference in his Hollywood hotel room and cleared me completely. Jackson, a California Republican, had spent the day phoning the majority of the other committee members, and his statement was authorized by them. He told reporters that I had freely admitted having registered as a communist in 1936, but that there was no evidence that I had ever belonged to the Communist Party or voted communist or attended any communist meeting or even known that my name had been listed on the party's state committee. He said that the House committee had known about my registration for a year and had not thought it fair to divulge it, but that independent investigators had come across the record recently. The consequent spreading of rumors had threatened irreparable damage to Miss Ball. Desi brought me the news of Representative Jackson's statement in my dressing room. "Today, I've learned who my friends are," I told him. This official clearance meant that we could go on with the show. But before me was the terrible ordeal of facing an audience packed with reporters and curiosity seekers. I stood waiting for my cue with a face white as chalk. A doctor stood by because, as Vivian said later, I think if Lucy had heard one boo from that audience, she'd have collapsed. Desi gave the warm-up in his usual breezy way. Welcome to the first I Love Lucy show of the season, he said. We are glad to have you back, and we're glad to be back ourselves. But before we go on, I want to talk to you about something serious. Something very serious. You all know what it is. The papers have been full of it all day. He had a little typed speech in his hand, but at this point he tucked it into his pocket. His voice broke, and then he went on with deep emotion. Lucy has never been a communist. Not now, and never will be. The audience applauded for a full minute. I was kicked out of Cuba, Desi continued, because of communism. We despise everything about it. Lucy is as American as Bernie Baruch and Ike Eisenhower. On Saturday, the complete transcript of Lucy's testimony will be released to the papers, and you can read it for yourself. The audience stood up and cheered. Someone yelled, "We're with you, boy!" Then Desi introduced Bill Frawley and Vivian Vance, who came out and smiled. Then he said, "Now, I want you to meet my favorite wife, my favorite redhead. In fact, that's the only thing red about her, and even that's not legitimate. Lucille Ball." Feeling as stiff as an iron poker, I walked out into the limelight. I couldn't speak, but my features were fraught with emotion. Still speechless with tears in my eyes, I turned and walked back through the curtains. My years of rigid self-discipline paid off that night. I lost myself in Lucy and clowned and cavorted without a sign of strain. At the end of the show, the cast came out, as usual, for a farewell bow. My Lucy voice, that high, bubbly, childlike voice, dropped to my normal low tones. "God bless you for being so kind," I told them. Finally, in my dressing room, I gave way to the tears I had been holding in since early morning. True to Desi's promise, we had 50 copies or more made of my testimony before William Wheeler and distributed them to the press at the ranch the next afternoon. Among the 30 reporters there to receive them were many who had known me since my Goldwyn Girl days. I considered them firm friends. Still, I was understandably nervous as Desi distributed the sheets of testimony I had given under oath. The reporters sat soberly reading for 10 minutes or so. Then one of them stood up and said to his colleagues, "I think we owe both Desi and Lucy a vote of thanks for this chance to set the record straight. And I think a lot of irresponsible people owe them an apology." Someone asked me how Walter Winchell found out about my registration. "Walter Winchell," I replied, "knew I was pregnant before I did." Desi told them, "William Wheeler told Lucy, after he heard her testimony, that she was politically immature. Hell, she couldn't even tell you who the governor of California was last year. And her grandfather was a character right out of You Can't Take It With You." Winchell apologized for his inaccurate reporting the following night, just 1 week after his words had initiated the furor. If our sponsor had canceled our contract, it was entirely likely that no sponsor or network would have been willing to carry us. And with the fall of the Lucy Show, Desi Lu Productions would have collapsed too, affecting thousands of people and costing us millions of dollars. As it was, only one store in the whole country canceled orders for I Love Lucy merchandise. I received over 4,000 letters, of which only 2 were critical. In the following months, I was chosen Television's Woman of the Year for the 2nd time. And President Eisenhower invited me and Desi to dinner at the White House. And Lucy remained the #1 show in popularity in the United States. I was one of the lucky ones. For a long time, people in Hollywood couldn't get a job because of unfounded and vicious smear rumors. If news of my registration had been revealed during the worst witch-hunting days between 1945 and 1950, my career probably would have been finished. Jack Gould later wrote about this incident in the New York Times. For once, the accusation and rebuttal became known simultaneously, and the public had an opportunity to judge and act for itself. Did millions of viewers as one man swear to forego Philip Morris cigarettes because 17 years ago Miss Ball registered as a communist voter? To the contrary, they deluged her with wires of support. He added, "The courteous and fair treatment which she was accorded should not be unique, but rather should become standard for cases of this kind. Broadcasting should study Miss Ball's case to see whether it does not provide a formula for handling its loyalty problem with far more maturity and equity than previously have been displayed. The procedure that is available to the biggest star should also be available to the bit player in similar trouble." When I Love Lucy was in the middle of its third season, Desi and I decided to take a break and fly to New York for a few days' rest. We knew that we were number one on TV, and we'd just been told that nobody went to the John during the half hour we were on Monday nights, but we hadn't begun to realize the tremendous impact of television. We commuted between the ranch and the studio from Monday to Friday, and on weekends saw other show business people, just as we had in the old days. In Hollywood, you generally work and party with your colleagues. It makes for an isolated sort of life. As Frank Capra once said, "In Hollywood, we learn about life from each other's pictures." We knew that MGM had a few things lined up for us to promote the Long Long Trailer, which was having its New York premiere, but mainly our idea was to have a short vacation from the daily grind. The trip started one Wednesday night in February 1954, with a tearful goodbye at the ranch to Lucy, age 2½, and Desi, who was 1. It was the first time we'd left them for more than a day or two. We flew through the night toward New York so fast that I never had time to get my girdle off. We sat up all night. The plane's water pipes froze, making it impossible to freshen up before getting off. We landed at Idlewild at 7 a.m. and were flabbergasted to be met by a huge crowd, a host of dignitaries and a 16-piece German marching band. Desi and I mugged and hugged, then kissed and waved before sashaying down a red carpet stretching from the plane to the terminal. When you're a movie star, your public image can still be vague because you look a little bit different in each picture. When you're seen in public, people nudge each other and whisper, "Is that?" and generally come up with a wrong name. But we soon discovered that when you play a continuing character on television, even if they've only seen you on screen once or twice, everyone on the street recognizes you instantly. Desi and I were bowled over by the number of people who stopped us on the streets in New York and the nice things they said. One afternoon, we went down to the 7th Avenue Garment District to talk to the manufacturer of I Love Lucy dresses. It tickled me when a tousled-haired old woman threw open the window of her tenement apartment and called admiringly to us, "Say, Lucy, that guy of yours sure gives you hell." Our first night in New York, we made a personal appearance on the stage of Radio City Music Hall, the first time the management had ever allowed such a promotion for a picture. "We've had many wonderful thrills in our life, Lucy and I," Desi told the audience. "But when we were sitting at home and got the phone call telling us that our first movie together was going to open at Radio City Music Hall and that we were going to play the most famous theater in the world together, we knew it was one of the greatest thrills we could ever have." I wore a beautiful white chiffon gown with all my diamonds. Desi was in black tie. "I've always dreamed of walking across the stage of the music hall," I told the audience, and did just that from one end to the other. Back in our dressing rooms after our appearance, I felt an immense weariness. We'd been on the go for 48 hours, with only a brief hour's catnap on the plane. But Desi wouldn't hear of heading for bed. "Miss the chance to see our opening at the music hall? Are you crazy?" No promise of seeing the movie some other day would deter him, so we all headed for the loges. Milton Berle, a close friend, came to pay his respects after the picture. "You know that scene where the trailer almost went off the cliff?" he asked us. 10 more feet and I'd have been number one. That night, following our music hall appearance, Desi and I went to see Kind Sir with Mary Martin and Charles Boyer. We arrived late at the theater just as the first curtain was going up and scurried to our seats as unobtrusively as possible. During the first intermission, Mary Martin sent us a note to please come to her dressing room,
After a pleasant chat, we returned to our seats while the house lights were still up. We sat there talking until we noticed a little hubbub of voices and the buzz-buzz of excited recognition.
"Mrs. Roosevelt must be here," I told Desi.
We craned our necks toward the back of the theater, and then we heard applause and saw people getting up, so we stood up too, clapping and looking around for the former First Lady. Then we realized the ovation was for us. Every time we tried to sit down, the applause grew louder. They had to hold the curtain. This was the shocker of all time, as far as Desi and I were concerned. The next night, we had dinner with the Charles Ruggleses, and then hurried late to the theater to see Tea House of the August Moon. When the lights went up after the first act, there was a murmur of voices which grew into shouts and cheers. What with people hanging over the balcony yelling, "Hey, Ricky!" and "Lucy, we love you!" and requesting autographs, they had to hold the second curtain a good long time. Then they brought the lights down dim, and Davy Wayne, God bless him, came out in Japanese kimono and bowed and said, "We too love Lucy." The following night, we had a dinner and theater date with June Havoc and her husband, Bill Spear. As we ate a quiet dinner in our hotel suite, Desi and I told them about our lampooning at the Circus Saints and Sinners luncheon at the Waldorf and about the spontaneous ovations which had greeted us everywhere at Blase 21, at the Copacabana, and at every theater. June listened, politely, if a bit wide-eyed, and said, "Well, I'm certainly looking forward to going to the theater with you two tonight. This is going to be pretty interesting." Now, of course, the minute she said that, I started thinking, oh, God, what if it doesn't happen tonight? I mean, Desi and I had been bouncing around town for 3 days, and the excitement was bound to die down. Desperate not to be embarrassed and humiliated, I started trying to analyze why and how we had gotten all those standing ovations, and decided it was because no one saw us until intermission, and all recognized us at the same time, which must have helped create all the extra excitement. So now I'm doing anything I can think of to delay our arrival until the lights are down. I'm pretending I can't find my gloves, dropping an earring. Nothing works. We arrive a few minutes before curtain. The four of us walk through the lobby and down to our orchestra seats. Nothing. I'm desperate now. I can't believe I did this, but I turned all the way around and nonchalantly looked up toward the balcony. The couple behind us smiled. I was afraid to even look at Havoc. When I sat down in my seat, she was still standing, just staring deadpan at me. Seconds later, we were in tears. We laughed so hard. She'll never let me forget it. You have to learn to live with recognition and fame, and more important, you have to realize why you're famous. The I Love Lucy show was love personified. It was little domestic spats and upsets happily concluded, an exaggeration of American life that came out all right. The next morning, we learned that the long, long trailer was definitely a hit. The Radio City Music Hall had enjoyed the biggest Sunday and Washington's birthday in its entire history, with lines stretching from the theater clear to Fifth Avenue. Metro booked an additional $1.5 million of showings across the country following this news. I was particularly pleased to be able to be a moneymaker for Pandro Berman, the producer of the picture and my old boss at RKO. He must have been thinking to himself, "My God, she finally made it in pictures." I did a lot of thinking during our warm and tumultuous New York welcome. "For 10 hot minutes, you're such a great celebrity," I told myself. 10 minutes later, you're just another actress. Hedda Hopper says that I'm one of the few actresses in Hollywood who survived my encounter with success in a single piece, only slightly battered as a consequence. There are many days when I feel more than slightly battered. For there's a lot of masochism in the acting profession. We're willing to take a lot of punishment, but the minute we hit a little bit of success, we are liable to run from it. We're frightened of it and develop all kinds of phobias as a consequence. Outsiders who don't understand think we have a chip on our shoulder, but it's not that at all. We're so used to failure, to being hurt and rebuffed, that we can easily come unhinged by success. 13. While we were at the peak of our popularity with I Love Lucy, I continued to feel guilt-ridden and anxious. I don't deserve all this love and adulation, I said to myself. I couldn't believe my two beautiful, healthy babies were really mine. I kept half expecting some terrible tragedy to happen to them. I'll always be grateful to Mrs. Charles Ruggles for taking me to hear Dr. Norman Vincent Peale for the first time during our big New York welcome. Listening to the doctor speak in his Marble Collegiate Church, I was moved to tears. Here was a man who spoke my language, who offered me a practical, everyday kind of religion. We have kept in close touch ever since that first meeting. Whenever problems pile up on me, I take them to Dr. Peale, and he always comes up with an answer that works for me. Dr. Peale helped me realize that our professional achievements are secondary. The important thing in life is our relationship with other human beings. It's not what we set out to get, but how we go about the daily task of living. Dr. Peale advised me to stop feeling guilty. Is it right for you to worry about your children? You wouldn't have them if God didn't want you to, and if he didn't feel you deserved them. He gave me many steadying words to think about when we returned to Hollywood. That New York trip in the winter of 1954 marked a real turning point in our lives. Before this, we had lived very simply. Whenever the upholstery or the wallpaper needed replacing, I picked the material and patterns as before. Our little ranch house was still a riot of cabbage rose wallpaper and trailing ivy and petty point embroidery. But we were working so many long hours that the 25-mile commute to the valley was a real problem. So we sold the ranch to Jane Withers and bought a white Georgian brick house next to Jack Benny's on Roxbury Drive in Beverly Hills. Desi also acquired some acres facing the Thunderbird Country Club fairway in Palm Springs, with an uninterrupted view of dazzling green turf and snow-capped Mount San Jacinto. There, we built a low, one-story, contemporary beige stone house with 6 bedrooms and 6 baths, a swimming pool, gardens, and tropical plantings both indoors and out. We soon found out that although it was one of the most beautiful golf courses in Palm Springs, Thunderbird was also one of the most prejudiced. Not only did it refuse to admit Jews, but celebrity and property owner or not, Desi was not invited to join either. So Desi, always a frustrated architect at heart, also began building a lavish motel in Palm Springs next to the Indian Wells Country Club. "We won't discriminate against Gentiles, Jews, or Cubans," Desi airily told the press. Desi sank $1 million into our Western Hills motel. It has only 42 lavish bedrooms, which works out to an investment of about $24,000 per rental unit. The main dining room has a sunken bar which features drinks from Desi's personal Cuban recipes. The architect tested the drinks first and decided to make the bar sunken so customers wouldn't have so far to fall. The house orchestra for a long time was the band Desi toured the country with from 1945 to 1950. Even though I knew it made sense, it upset me terribly to leave the ranch. I refused to go near the place while everything was being packed. Most of the furniture we gave away, although I still have a few Victorian chairs and beds in my guest house in Beverly Hills. I ordered new, contemporary living room and bedroom suites from, where else? Jamestown, New York. The order was flown to Los Angeles in a special chartered airplane. For the front hallway, I chose a beautiful Japanese silk print that cost $90 a roll. A hideous extravagance, I thought, but Desi kept assuring me that we could afford it. As soon as it was hung, I realized something I hadn't noticed before. It had shadowy birds all over it. The wallpaper came down the next day. We spent 6 months remodeling the Beverly Hills place before we moved in. Finally, we had 5 bedrooms and 5 baths. We lived at the Beverly Hills Hotel while the work was being done, and Desi drove himself mercilessly. For years, Hollywood had regarded him as just another hotcha Latin charm boy. They never thought he had the brains or savvy to become a big business tycoon. As a matter of fact, his business acumen amazed me, too. As writer-producer Cy Howard says, Desi built a television image with tremendous theatrical flair and courage. He was also the shrewdest businessman I ever knew. Unlike most Hollywood tycoons, he could make million-dollar decisions without welching and without fear. Desi was by nature an easygoing, music-loving Latin who, left to his own devices, would sleep every day until noon. He learned to be tough, but he didn't really enjoy it. Since Desilu was his baby, he felt he had to be on top of every deal. His 18-hour days were filled with big business squabbles, clashing personalities, and long hours of rehearsals. Business meetings went on far into the night, and he was generally up and on the telephone with New York by 6 or 7 a.m. When enough aggravation accumulated, he'd blow his stack at home. At Desilu, he was the kindest, most considerate boss who ever lived. He agreed with me that creative people should be given a lot of leeway and shouldn't have to account for every minute of their time. If a talented writer seldom showed up before 2 in the afternoon, that was all right with Desi, providing he got his scripts done. But at home, one button off a shirt could make Desi go to pieces. Finally, on May 5th, 1955, our new home was ready for us. Little Lucy and Desi looked forward with glee to all their new playmates in the neighborhood. Dean Martin's 7 kids, Jeannie Crane Brinkman's 6, and 5 little Farrars at Rosemary Clooney's. Desi carried me over the threshold of our new home with a flourish, then stopped and gasped. During the night, the water pipes in the 18-year-old house had burst. The thick, white, wall-to-wall carpet was a stained, sodden mess. The wallpaper was streaked. The newly plastered walls were disintegrating. Desi really flipped. As the children huddled against me in terror, he ranted, raged, stormed, kicked the walls, and then began tearing them down with his bare hands. "Come, dears," Dee Dee told the babies. "Your father is rehearsing," and she bundled them out of the place. I had never seen Desi in such a state. I was terrified he was going to seriously hurt himself. I realized for the first time how the strain of our snowballing empire was eating away at him. A month or two later, we finished our 4th season of I Love Lucy and immediately began making a movie together, Forever Darling. I haven't been in many flops in my life, but this one was pretty bad. Desi played a scientist working on a new insecticide. I was his screwball wife who went along on a field trip to help. The picture was made hastily with a poor script. Both critics and public panned it. But at least it inspired a beautiful song and a wonderful homecoming to Jamestown, where the world premiere was held in early February 1956. We arrived during a blinding rainstorm in a helicopter from Buffalo. As I excitedly pointed out the landmarks to Desi, our little whirlybird slowly circled the town, then landed at the high school football field. 25,000 people were waiting on the sidewalks to see us. They shouted enthusiastically in the cold, driving rain. Mothers with babies, women in sodden fur coats, young and old. Dee Dee and I were thunderstruck. It was even more exciting to me than our New York reception 2 years before. Desi was so touched that he left the limousine and rode on top of the fire truck in the parade. He took his hat off to wave and smile, arriving at the hotel drenched and shivering, but with the whole city in the palm of his hand. He was absolutely marvelous for the whole 3 days and charmed everyone. The most sentimental occasion for me was the party I'd arranged for my Celeron classmates and our beloved principal, Bernard Drake. They came from hundreds of miles away. Some of them I hadn't seen for 20 years. "Now, don't tell me your name," I told them, circling the room. I was eager to make my old classmates feel comfortable. Fame can be a tremendous barrier, one I hoped to break down. I couldn't remember all their names, but in most cases I could remember some specific thing about them. "Your mother kept a red bowl on the sideboard," or "You had a green bicycle." The last person in line was a short, bald, sweet-faced man. He looked up shyly while Pauline Lopez smiled impishly at my side. I kept looking at this stranger, totally mystified. At last, Pauline burst out, "That's Vinny." Vinny Myers? My 8th grade beau. Here I had begged Pauline to make certain he'd be there, and I didn't even recognize him. Well, I whooped, then hugged and kissed him. Desi came over and shook his hand and slapped him on the back. "So you're the one I've been jealous of all these years, huh?" It was quite the highlight of the trip.
Desi went with me to see Grandfather's little house in Celeron. The yard was still spacious, ringed